Ja, herzlich willkommen. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce Jean and John Komarov to you who will be tonight contribute to our lecture series Decentering Europe, Postcolonial and Post-Bloc Perspectives for Reflexive European Ethnology. Given the influence and importance of your work for critical and postcolonial anthropology, and given the big number of people who have come here to attend tonight's lecture, I believe that I do not need to say much more about your past work. Jean and John Komarov are currently staying at the Viennese International Research Center for Cultural Studies as guests of the director, and they have kindly agreed to follow our invitation on quite short notice. On behalf of the Institute and its laboratory, Europe, Europeanization, let me thank you for coming and let me welcome you cordially to Berlin. Today's lecture has borrowed its title from your current volume in preparation, Theory from the South, or How Europe is Evolving Towards Africa. By taking on this perspective, I have learned this from the announcement of your publisher, you are seeking to reverse the usual order of things. And if I make this comparison, just as Marx has announced that his dialectical method does not only differ from Hegel's in its foundation, but in fact is its opposite, it seems to me that your approach does not only turn things back on their feet, but moreover that it wants to use the global moment that we find ourselves in today as an opportunity to venture to completely new political and social relations and relationalities in this world. So we are very happy that you take us on board for this enterprise tonight, and we are eagerly awaiting to hear your thoughts and maybe even a proposal. The stage is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for that generous and exceedingly, if I may say, insightful introduction. And thank you to all who've come and to those who made this visit possible. The idea is very simple, really, although its implications could be quite radical. We ourselves have essayed it many times over the past two decades, and so have others, especially other others. And it is this. Western Enlightenment thought has, from the first, posited itself as the wellspring of universal learning, of science and philosophy in the upper case. Concomitantly, it has regarded the non-West, variously known as the ancient world, the Orient, the primitive world, the third world, the underdeveloped world, the developing world, and now the global South, primarily as a place of parochial wisdom, of antiquarian traditions, of exotic ways and means. Above all, a source of unprocessed data. Those other worlds, in short, are treated less as sources of refined knowledge than as reservoirs of raw fact, of the historical, natural, and ethnographic minutiae from which Euro-modernity might fashion its testable theories, its transcendent truths, its axioms, and its certitudes. Just as it has long capitalized on the non-Western raw materials by ostensibly adding value and refinement to them. In some measure, this continues to be the case. But what if, and here is the idea in the interrogative form, what if we invert that order of things? What if we posit that, in the present moment, it is the global South that affords privileged insights into the workings of the world at large? And I use the global South in quotes. As you'll see, we use it ironically, I hope, throughout. That it is from here that our empirical grasp of the lineaments and our theory work in accounting for them ought to be coming, at least in major part. What follows is a reflection on the contemporary order of things, approached primarily from an African vantage, one I hope with its share of surprises and counterintuitives, inviting us to see familiar things perhaps in different ways. Euro-American social theory, as writers from the South have long observed, has tended to treat modernity as if it were inseparable from Aufklärung, the rise of Enlightenment reason. Not only is each taken to be a condition of the other's possibility, the dungeons of the world are taking, yes, the gods are rumbling. Together they are assumed to have animated a distinctively European mission to emancipate humankind from its uncivil prehistory.
I think we need to turn that off wherever it is.
From a life of bare necessity, enchantment, and entropy. Whether the Enlightenment is seen as an epoch or an attitude, as vested in Kantian critique or positivist science, in self-possessed subjectivity or civic democracy, in Arendt's laboring society or Marx's capitalist mode of production, in the free market or liberal humanism, or in various ensembles of these things, the modern has its fons et origo in the West. This notwithstanding the fact that in the West the term has always been an object of contestation and ambivalence. So, contra Sheikh Anta Diop, the Senegalese polymath, for whom civilization arose in Egypt, thence to make its way northwards, other modernities are generally taken to be either transplants or simulacra, their very mention marked by ironic scare quotes. The accomplishment of anything like the real thing, the Euro original, is presumed at best to be deferred into a dim, distant, almost unimaginable future, to which, as Frantz Fanon has put it, if the colonized do arrive, it is always too late. Everything is already anticipated, thought out, demonstrated, made the most of. To the degree that, from a Western perspective, the global South is embraced by modernity at all, then, it is as an outside that requires translation, conversion, catch-up. Take two diverse instances, both involving North-South representation. One is literary. It is J.M. Coetzee's story, The Novel in Africa, set on a cruise ship called, tellingly, The Northern Lights. The narrative hinges on a conversation between a Nigerian writer and Elizabeth Costello, the Australian novelist who serves as Coetzee's alter ego. How can you explain a world in all its depth, Costello asks the man, if at the same time you are having to explain it to outsiders, to Europeans, that is? From the standpoint of northerly enlightenment, African prose is taken to be a performance of otherness, not an act of self-writing, to use Achille Mbembe's term. As Zizek observes, the universality presumed by Western liberalism, and here I quote him, does not reside in the fact that its values, human rights, etc., are universal in the sense of holding for all cultures, but in a much more radical sense. In it, Western liberalism, individuals relate to themselves as universal. That is, they participate in the universal dimension directly, bypassing their individual social position. Unquote. But the African author is foreclosed from writing in the cosmopolitan voice, taken for granted by literati in Euro-America. If he/she speaks out of Africa, it requires explanation, conversion into the lexicon of liberal universalism, of the humanist episteme on which it is based. Our other example is scholarly. It refers to the social sciences in the global South. For Dipesh Chakrabarty, European historicism allows only one trajectory to non-Western societies if they are to be recognized as part of the grand human story. They must undergo a visible metamorphosis, fast or slow, effective or otherwise, to Western capitalist modernity. Their diverse, variously animated life worlds have to be translated into the universal and disenchanted language of sociology, as he puts it, whose telos declares, first in Europe, then elsewhere. Coetzee and Chakrabarty echo a long, slow, rising tide of critique. To be sure, the object of much post-colonial theory has been to disrupt the Western telos of modernity, to trouble the histories it presumes, to provincialize Europe, to re-narrate empire. All the better, Homi Bhabha insists, to move the project of theory-making to an eccentric site, thus to capture the restless, revisionary energy that comes from the vast reaches of the planetary population whose genealogies do not reach back directly to the European Enlightenment. Bhabha's call is echoed by those social scientists who argue for the distinctive forms of knowledge yielded by what they call peripheral vision, and by those who have pointed to the qualifications and question marks brought by non-Western experience to mainstream discourses about the nature of modernity itself. It is echoed also, as George Orwell or W.E.B. Du Bois long ago reminded us, in the life stories of those within the metropole, southerners in the north, so to speak, who are largely excluded from its human fellowship. More immediately, though, despite decades of post-colonial critique, the modernist social sciences, not excluding those of a more radical bent, tend still to bypass the third world, its narratives of modernity and the work of its intellectuals, in writing the planetary history of the present. Even critical theorists tend to take the driving engine of late modernity and late capitalism to lie wholly in Euro-America. In the upshot, the South continues to be the suppressed underside of the North. Which is why, in an important early intervention on the topic, Gayatri Spivak censured post-structuralism for failing to give account of geopolitics in its analyses of power and the sovereign subject. By ignoring the impact of the international division of labor on discourses and consciousness everywhere, she argued, and by rendering ideology invisible, post-structuralism participated in an economy of representation that kept the non-European other in the shadow of the Western self, thereby allowing the universal subject to remain securely on Euro-American terrain. Now, Spivak's point is well taken, but in dissecting the technologies of Eurocentrism, she tends herself to court the very psychic self-obsession that she critiques in post-structuralism. By focusing on the colonial narcissism of Europe, a narcissism that obliterates the trace of the colonized other in what she calls its own precarious subjectivity, she herself puts social and material conditions more or less under erasure. As a result, the subaltern is so fully eclipsed by an omnipotent Western selfhood as to be rendered inaudible, unspeaking, and unspeakable. But they, the colonized after all our collective and social category, are not quite so easily effaced, despite their multiple displacements. Why not? Precisely because, being active, sentient human subjects, they are more than just a necessary supplement to the production of European consciousness, not to mention European material, moral, and political life. Even at their most inarticulate, the unsettling presence of those others has always troubled imperial aspirations, demanding constant oversight. Like Rochester's West Indian wife in the attic, this is the story of Emily Bronte's Jane Eyre that Edward Said has alerted us to, the dark stranger in the attic was repeatedly threatening to disrupt polite society in the metropole. What is more, because colonial societies were complex formations, they entered into complex, unpredictable relations with Europe. Metropole and colony, after all, were co-constitutive elements of a rising world capitalist order. Entailed, that is, in what Deleuze and Guattari have called a double capture, an encounter that transforms the disparate entities that enter into a joint becoming. Hence the recognition by Spivak and others that colonies were integral sources of value and innovation for modern nation-states in the North. At the same time, the colonized were excluded from full citizenship in those imagined communities. Worse yet, colonial polities were sustained by acts of violence that flew in the face of the tenets of liberal European law and civility. For imperial frontiers were places of partial visibility, where working misunderstandings bred reciprocal fetishisms, unwritten agreements, unruly populations, protean social arrangements that were held to require particularly forceful techniques of control. Above all, these frontiers fostered conjunctures of Western and non-Western values, desires, conventions, and practices, fusions that fueled the destructive, innovative urges of modernity, but with little of the ethical restraint that held them back at home. Sometimes, too, those frontiers were fertile staging grounds, even laboratories, for ways of doing things that were not possible elsewhere. Experiments in urban architecture and planning, in brutally profitable modes of labor discipline, in racially engineered public health regimes, and in untried practices of governance, bureaucracy, and lawfare, warfare, property, and pedagogy. Nor is this all in the distant past. In 2000, the year 2000, the U.S. Republican Senator Tom DeLay prevented legislation that would have banned sweatshop conditions in the Northern Mariana Islands, an American territory in the Pacific. Said DeLay to the Washington Post, and I quote him, "The low-wage anti-union conditions of the Marianas constitute a perfect petri dish, i.e. a test tube, for capitalism." Unquote. The edges of empire also permitted bold forays across established lines of sexuality, race, and culture that opened up unfamiliar sorts of intimacy and modes of reproduction. Sometimes, as for the 19th century writer Charles Kingsley, the vigor and the vitality of those frontiers threw light on the bloodless decadence of modernity back home in Europe, which in turn ensured that the traces of colonial others, of the constitutive outside, as it were, could never be fully removed or repressed. Just as Euro-modernity sowed its seeds among those others, so the signs and spoils, the indictments and injuries of the colony, made themselves palpably present in the domestic politics and the moral imagination of the metropole, breaching its boundaries and inflecting its interiors. As this suggests, modernity was almost from the start a North-South collaboration, indeed a world historical production, albeit a sharply asymmetrical one. Whatever its political conceits, however hard it may seek to purify itself, it has always consisted of multiple significations, materializations, temporalities, perpetually contested, hard to pin down, historically labile. As an ideology, moreover, it has never been dissociable from capitalism, from its determinations and social logic, although, to be sure, fascism and socialism have sought their own versions of it. Hyphenated capitalist modernity has realized itself, if very unevenly, in the great aspirations of liberalism, but it has also excluded many populations from just these things, especially in colonial theatres, those who have been subjugated to its modes of extraction, or worse yet, those who have been rendered disposable by virtue of having nothing of value to extract. Precisely because it has plied its abrasive course in so many disparate contexts, in other words, modernity has always been both one thing and many, always both a universal project and a host of specific parochial emplacements, a force for equality and a producer of difference. This is self-evidently true in Europe, where national imaginings have never been all alike, neither within nation-states or between them. Hence the rise of a discursive domain dubbed broadly comparative modernities. But it has been even more so in Europe's distant peripheries, where in the shadow of various metropoles, modernity was made at a discount. Colonies were pale proxies, subsidiary holding companies, as it were, for sovereign Western powers. Here the violence and the magic, the syncretism and the archaism suppressed in Europe were often promiscuously visible. So too were the local inventions, accommodations and hybrids produced in different colonial contexts. The work relations, the forms of domestic and urban life, the displaced cosmopolitanisms forged in the spaces between promise and privation, inclusion and erasure, here to assert their own contemporaneity, their own modernity. Here then is the point. To the degree that the making of modernity has been a world historical process, it can as well be narrated from its undersides as it can from its self-proclaimed centres, like those maps that, as a cosmic joke, invert the planet Earth to place the south on the top and the north below. But we seek to do more than just turn the story upside down, thus to leave intact the Manichaean dualism that holds Euro-America and its others in the same fixed embrace. We seek also to do more than merely note that many of the emergent features and concealed contradictions of capitalist modernity were as readily perceptible in the colony as in the metropole, or that the former was often the site of production of the ways and means of the latter. What we suggest, in addition, is that contemporary world historical processes are visibly altering received geographies of core and periphery, relocating southwards not only some of the most innovative and energetic modes of producing value, but the driving impulse of contemporary capitalism as both a material and a cultural formation. It is in this light that we propose that the history of the present may be more thoroughly grasped alike empirically and theoretically from the vantage of the Antipodes. In making this claim, theory from the South is built on two closely interwoven arguments. We build them, as we have intimated, by taking Africa as our point of departure. The first argument is that modernity in the South is not adequately understood as a derivative or a doppelganger or a counterfeit of some Euro-American original. To the contrary, it demands to be apprehended and addressed in its own right. Afro-modernity, which, as S.M. Masilela shows, has a deep history, is a polymorphous mutating ensemble of signs and practices, in terms of which people across the continent have long made their lives. This partly in dialectical relationship with the global north and its expansive imperium, partly with others in the same hemisphere, partly in localized enclaves. As in the north, Afro-modernity has manifested itself in a number of registers at once, from the literary to the lay, the philosophical to the pragmatic. As in the north, it has been mired in ambivalence, contestation, entangled meanings. Should Afro-modernity be part of a universal enlightenment, of Christianity and civilization, of Shakespearean English and scientific reason, as some black South African intellectuals argued in the early 20th century? Should it choose only the good things of that civilization and discard the rest, as R.V. Selope Thema once put it? Or should it combine the native and the alien, the traditional and the foreign, into something new and beautiful, as H.I.E. Dlomo wrote in 1939? In point of fact, there has been a steady move from the first to the third option, a move that is towards the mimetic, understood here as a process that establishes similarities with something else, while at the same time inventing something totally original. Like its European counterpart, Afro-modernity entailed a regenesis, a consciousness of new possibilities, and a rupture with the past, a past that in the upshot was flattened out, detemporalized, and congealed into tradition, which of course is itself a thoroughly modern construct. Afro-modernity, in sum, has always had its own trajectories, giving moral and material shape to everyday life. It has yielded diverse yet distinctive means by which to make sense of the world, to fashion beings and identities, to act effectively on contemporary conditions. Africa has long provided what is arguably the most dynamic revisions anywhere of popular Protestantism, for example, and some of the most innovative genres of mass cultural creativity, from Afrobeat and highlight to the mighty Nollywood straight-to-video film industry. Such creativity has been at once productive and destructive, flouting, repudiating, and remaking European lifeways. Sometimes the process has been strikingly self-conscious, as among Xhosa intellectuals of the 1880s, and later black South Africans of the New Africa movement, not least Pixley Seme, who famously insisted in the regeneration of Africa that the continent not be compared with Europe, since it had its own genius, that it was a giant awakening, entering a higher complex existence, a unique civilization. There to be inseminated, one may add, by the other influences from the South, from those of Gandhi to the African diaspora in the New World. So there's been a long debate about the nature of modernity, so to say. Much the same rhetoric was to suffuse anti-colonial movements and post-independent nationalisms. Kwame Nkrumah quoted Seme at length in opening the first International Congress of Africanists in 1964. That rhetoric is also audible in the assertive alterities of Pan-Africanism, Ethiopianism, negritude and Afrocentrism, in new African fiction and theatre, in experiments with communitarianism, democracy, born-again belief, in high-minded visions like Ubuntu, the call for a generic African humanity, or even more ambitiously, in the African Renaissance. At other times, Afro-modernity has lain implicit in signs and practices, aesthetic values, and indigenous ways of knowing. Nor is it best labelled an alternative modernity, singular or plural. It is a vernacular, just as Euro-modernity is a vernacular, wrought in an ongoing situated engagement with the unfolding history of the present. It is important in this respect to distinguish modernity from modernization, a point that takes us away from Africa for a moment into the more general terrain. allow us this discretion, this digression, before we go on to the second of our arguments, which will return us squarely to the issue of hearing from the South. Modernity refers to an orientation to being in the world, to a variously construed and inhabited Weltanschauung, to a concept of the person, a self-actualizing subject, to an ideal of humanity as species being, to a vision of history as a progressive man-made construction, to the pursuit of justice via rational governance, to a relentless impetus toward innovation whose very iconoclasm breeds a longing for things eternal. Modernization, by contrast, posits a strong unilinear trajectory towards a particular vision of the future, capitalist, socialist, whatever, toward which all humanity should aspire, towards which all history leads, if at different rates. This telos has expressed itself in self-styled progressive movements, both secular and religious, in expansive models of improvement, and in objective scientific paradigms, among them modernization theory in sociology. It has also been censured for the contradictions between its promises and its effects, between, for example, the promise of a more equal humanity and the burgeoning biopolitics of difference across the world. We are less concerned here with these contradictions than with the confusion between modernization and modernity. It underpins a recent debate about the latter, about modernity as category of critical analysis, and it raises a clutch of theoretical issues that are salient to our argument. Now, Frederick Cooper, whose own scholarly corpus is also rooted in Africa, has recently complained that modernity is ever more imprecisely used as a technical term in the academy. We agree, having remarked ourselves on its vagueness, its tendency to melt into air under scrutiny. We concur, too, with his observation that its analytic and everyday connotations are often confused and conflated, although this is as true of other constructs in the vocabulary of the human sciences, like colonialism, identity, politics, liberalism, even theory. In point of fact, it is precisely the protean quality of modernity that has made it so productive as a trope of worldly claim-making, as a political assertion, and as an object of analysis. Modernity, plainly, is what linguists call a shifter. It is used relatively, in large part to define its own obverse, to put people in particular times and places, on the far and near side of a great divide between self and other, present and prehistory, here and there, the general and the particular, oppositions that are mobilized in a range of registers, from theologies to party platforms, from policy documents to black letter law, from maps of social space to classifications of populations. The positivist social sciences have also deployed this grammar of oppositions, of course. Hence the embrace of such fundamental contrasts as mechanical versus organic solidarity, status versus contract, Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft, savage and civilized, pre-capitalist, capitalist, and so on. Modernization theory, ascendant in sociology from the 1950s, was no exception. It set out to isolate the variables according to which human populations might be placed along an imagined continuum from pre to modern, past to present. Despite having been subjected to repeated critique, Cooper argues, and this takes us to the center of the debate, he argues that both the conceptual foundations and the Eurocentric telos of that paradigm of modernization linger on, and he takes particular aim at post-colonial scholarship. As a result, he said that scholarship reinforces the meta-narratives that it pretends to take apart, thereby muddying rather than illuminating the question of African modernity, of what it actually is and how we might typify it. For theorists like Cooper, the problem is to be solved by a strong dose of rigorous historical practice, as though a protean phenomenon like this might finally be pinned down by recourse to frank empiricism. Ironically, by the canons of just such frank empiricism, post-colonial studies are not quite so easily dismissed. There is work in that tradition that has taken pains to transcend the assumptions and methods of modernization theory. Constructs like alternative modernities have their problems, but they were developed precisely to move beyond the binary opposition between the pre-modern and the modern, and to avoid conflating modernization with westernization. But there is something else here, something more general. The effort to counter the indiscriminate uses of modernity underscores why it is so important not to mistake it for modernization, or to use modernity as an analytical construct without also considering the conditions of its material existence. Cooper laments that, with the repudiation of modernization theory, everything tends to be treated as simultaneously modern. But that in part was the very object of the critique, to show that while modernization as Western ideology might have represented the non-Western world as just so many not yet modern outsides, the capitalist imperium to which it is joined has no exteriors, although it has many peripheries. Its exclusions and its margins, as critical theorists of various stripes have stressed, are a requisite condition of the growth of its centres. What is more, to reveal the negative impact of modernizing processes perpetrated in the name of universal advancement, or to reject modernization as a technical term in the social sciences, is not to be against modernity, which some theorists of Cooper sort of suggested. It's not to be for it either, for that matter. It's to subject its history to critical interrogation. The point surely is to pay heed to the reality that many disadvantaged people across the world desire much of what they understand to be the modern, and to the degree that they can, to fashion their own versions of it, even as they live with its many constraints and contradictions, absences and aporias, which is where the empirical fact of multiple modernities came from to begin with. Acknowledging the widespread yearning for the elusive promise of progress patently does not preclude recognizing its destructive effects, or challenging the Eurocentric myth that there is only one authentic instance of it. Nor is the demand for its fruits among those deprived of them underplayed by accepting that there may be more than one modernity, a fear expressed by James Ferguson, who cautions that, in celebrating alternative modernities, we may all too easily neglect the real inequalities that still exist between centres and margins. Inequalities, one may add, that are to be found as much in the lumpen heart of the global metropoles as in some African remote region. It is not that people in the global south lack modernity. It is that many of them are deprived of the promise of modernization by the inherent propensity of capital to create edges and undersides in order to feed off them. Modernity is a concrete abstraction. It is in its realized manifest forms, it is the product of human activity, but it also exists as a reified order of imagined transactable value. In this sense, it is a big idea. The term refers both to something general and to things in particular, both to the singular and to the plural, and to the relations between them. It embraces the social, economic, cultural, and moral dimensions of life in specific times and places, and simultaneously it is invoked to describe the epochal and the universal. Multivalent constructs of this kind are as integral to theory work in the social sciences as they are to the everyday discourses of mass culture. The need to make sense of their practical semiosis would seem to be self-evident. Can one really argue, as Cooper does, that to use modernity in the plural rather than the singular, to treat it as anything more than a vernacular category, indeed, to elevate it to an abstraction at all, is to give it artificial coherence? What exactly is artificial about it, beyond the fact that every concept mobilized by the human sciences is ultimately an artifice? Why should it be that to recognize modernity as one thing and many is to fall into confusion? To bring this back to our own argument, it follows from what we've been saying that Afro-modernity is both a discursive construct and an empirical fact, both a singularity and a plurality, both a distinctive aspiration and a complicated set of realities, one, as the likes of Pixley Seme said long ago, that speak to a tortuous endogenous history, one still actively being made. A history, as it turns out, not running behind Euro-America, but ahead of it.
This brings us to our second argument. Contrary to received Euromodernist narratives of the past two centuries, which has the global south tracking behind the curve of universal history, always in deficit, always playing catch-up, there is good reason to think precisely the opposite. that in the here and now, it is the South that tends first to feel the effects of world historical forces, the South in which those forces are often first played out, thus to prefigure the future of the global North. It is this that we seek to capture in our pointedly provocative undertitle, How Euro-America is Evolving Toward Africa. Put another way, while Euro-America and the South are caught up in the same all-embracing world historical processes, old margins are becoming new frontiers, places where mobile, globally competitive capital finds minimally regulated zones in which to vest its operations, where industrial manufacture opens up ever more cost-efficient sites for itself, where highly flexible informal economies of the kind now expanding everywhere have long thrived, where those performing outsourced services for the North develop cutting-edge infotech empires of their own, both legitimate and illicit, where new idioms of work, of time, of value take root, thus to alter planetary practices. Which is why the Global South appears to be evolving, why the Global North appears to be evolving southward in many respects. Africa, South Asia, and Latin America appear to be running slightly ahead of the Euro-modern world, harbingers of its history in the making. There are many dimensions to this. In the book, we explore some of its highly technical aspects. We show, for example, how northern legal systems, especially in respect of civil, property, and family law, are becoming demonstrably more like African customary law. How new political movements and coalitions, even democratic party politics, are as well. How European nation states, having to come to terms ever more with demographic heterogeneity and a real sociology of difference, are beginning to resemble post-colonies, thus to re-theorize contemporary law, politics, and the nature of the nation-state. Here, however, we're concerned with more general processes, processes that run to the very heart of contemporary capitalism and its moral economy, to the means of primary production associated with it, to its preferred forms of labor extraction, to its modes of accumulating wealth and signifying value, to its political and legal geographies, to its interpolation in the institutions of governance. In recent decades, capital, with its growing stress on flexibility, liquidity, and deregulation, has yet again found untapped bounty in former colonies, where post-colonial states, anxious to garner disposable income and often put in desperate need of hard currency, have opened themselves up to business, specifically to corporations, now often based in China, in India, and in the Gulf, that have little compunction in pressuring ruling regimes to offer them tax incentives, to waive environmental controls, wage restrictions, and worker protections, to limit liability and discourage union activities, even to allow themselves to enclave, in short, to bow to laissez-faire at its most sovereign. As a result, it is largely in the South, Tom DeLay's preferred test tube of capitalism, that the practical workings of neoliberalism have been tried and tested. In them, that the outer bounds of its financial operations have been explored, thence to be re-imported to Euro-America. The North, of course, is now experiencing those practical workings ever more palpably as labor markets contract and employment is casualized, as manufacture moves away without warning, as big business seeks to coerce states to unmake eco-laws, to drop minimum wages, to subsidize its infrastructure, and to protect it from loss, from liability, and from taxation. As centre-right governments cut public spending, public institutions, and public sector jobs, this often over unavailing protests from civil society, which is why so many citizens of the West, of both labouring and middle classes, are having to face the insecurities and instabilities, the forced mobility and disposability long characteristic of life in the non-West. It is also why public intellectuals are now publishing mass-circulating books with titles like Third World America. The so-called New Normal of the North is replaying the recent past of the South in an ever more major key. At the same time, some nation states in the South, by virtue of having become economic powerhouses, India, Brazil, South Africa, Nigeria, evince features of the future of Euro-America in other ways, having opened up frontiers of their own and having begun to colonize the metropole. Vide the seizure of global initiative in the biofuel economy by Brazil, or the reach of the Indian auto industry into Britain, of which it now actually owns a major proportion. Or the impact of the Hong Kong banking sector on the development of new species of financial market. Or in yet another register, the emergence of South Africa, a major force in the international mineral economy, as the America of Africa, eager to experiment with constitutional law, with populist politics, and, if hesitantly, with post-neoliberal forms of economic redistribution, thereby having provided models to the legal profession, to the economics profession, and indeed to government, now followed in many parts of the world. Or, in yet another register, the rise of new forms of urbanism, as in Nigeria, where, according to Joshua Komaroff and Gulliver Shepherd, many of the trends of canonical modern Western cities can be seen in hyperbolic guise. Lagos, they say, is not catching up with us. Rather, we may be catching up with Lagos. That city, adds Rem Koolhaas, a theorist of the contemporary city, is, and we quote him, a paradigm for the future of all cities. A megalopolis, whose prime real estate is now more expensive than property in Manhattan, is at the forefront of globalizing modernity. Note, not of an alternative modernity, of modernity sui generis. The irony of this will be obvious to those familiar with Johannes Fabian's Time and the Other. The question now is not whether the West eschews, ignores, or misrecognizes the coevalness, the contemporaneity of the non-West with the West, which is what Fabian accused anthropology of doing, is whether the West recognizes that it is playing catch-up with the temporality of its others. In large part, it is the lumpen end of the story that is worked out first in the South, where much of the working class of the world is now dispersed. This perhaps accounts for the fact that some of the earliest critiques of the neoliberal term and the most skeptical responses to free market fundamentalism have come from those very undersides, this being another respect in which the global north has tracked behind its Antipodean counterparts. As long as 15, 20 years ago on public radio in South Africa, one was hearing debates about what neoliberalism consisted in at the very time that economists in Europe were denying that there was any such thing as neoliberalism at all. But why? Why has Africa in particular and the South in general come in significant respects to anticipate the unfolding history of Euro-America? Why, for good or ill, are the material, political, moral, social effects of the rise of neoliberalism most graphically evident there? We've already begun to address the question. The answer begins with the past, with the fact that most colonies were zones of occupation geared toward imperial extraction. To the degree that neo-colonial politics and economics have conspired to keep them that way, post-colonies have remained dependent and debt-strapped, tending still to export their resources as raw materials and unskilled labor, rather than as value-added commodities or competencies. This even as some of them, like Nigeria, Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, and again South Africa, have experienced real growth in their manufacturing industries, in their service sectors, and in urban consumer spending. Furthermore, first, because large sectors of their populations have long worked under conditions designed to depress wages and to disempower potentially dangerous classes. Second, because market forces in Africa have never been fully cushioned by the existence of a liberal democratic state and its forms of regularity. And third, because governance there has frequently been based on kleptocratic patronage, all of these things also in part being legacies of colonialism and its aftermath, African polities have been especially hospitable to rapacious enterprise, to asset stripping, to the alienation of the commons to privateers, to the plunder of personal property, to foreign bribe-giving and bribe-taking, in sum, to optimal profit at minimal cost, with little infrastructural development. A parenthesis here. Just a month ago, the federal government in the US wrote a report on what happened in 2008 in America. That last paragraph, as I have read it, could as well have come from that report as it could come of a description of anything African. The rapid increase of foreign direct investment in the south of the Sahara over the past decade. Capital inflows to Africa rose by 16% in 2008, while falling 20% worldwide, has led James Ferguson, among others, to speculate that African countries might be less sites of immature forms of globalization than advanced, sophisticated mutations of it. A recent report on African economies by none other than McKinsey, the McKinsey Global Institute, a conservative think tank, supports this view. Indeed, it underscores it. So does Brenda Chalfin's recent case study of Ghana, which has become a neoliberal pace setter by putting into play new regulatory techniques at a time when customs mandates are expanding everywhere in response to burgeoning transnational trade. With the involvement of multilateral agencies, she notes, we quote, Ghana functions in many respects as a laboratory for the testing out and the shaping of global modalities of governance. Again, for better or for worse, Africa is ahead of the curve. It is precisely the melange of its inherited colonial institutions and its post-colonial availability to neoliberal development that make Ghana and other nations of the South a vanguard in the epoch of the market. As Newsweek, itself not exactly known as a radical magazine, put in early 2010, Africa, and this is a quote, is at the very forefront of emerging markets. Like China and India, it is perhaps more than any other region of the contemporary world illustrative of the new world order. The US and Europe have colluded in this by imposing their future vision, infamously under the sign of structural adjustment, on Africa, Asia, and Latin America, inadvertently giving early warning of what lay in store for themselves. George Stieglitz has argued that the doctrinaire insistence on the liberalization of trade and of capital markets and the privatization of public assets is grossly unsuited to developing economies. In his view, it precipitated the Asian crisis of 1997, a history of failed development in Africa, and the meltdown in Argentina. The fallout provided a chilling preview of the effects of the global economic implosion of 2008. In terms that now sound prophetic, Stieglitz described how the nations of the East were thrown into chaos, how in order to protect international markets, the IMF rushed in with massive bailouts directed mainly at foreign creditors, leaving ordinary citizens to carry the costs, how financial stabilization rather than job creation became the prime objective, how money was available to save banks but not to compensate unemployed workers. The IMF, he argued, imbued with a blind faith in the wrong models, ignored critical knowledge in economics about the conditions under which markets actually operate. And we quote him at length. These conditions are highly restrictive. Indeed, recent advances in economic theory have shown that wherever information is imperfect and markets incomplete, which is to say always, the invisible hand works imperfectly. Significantly, there are always government interventions which in principle can improve upon the efficiency of the market. What Stieglitz, remember, Stieglitz, ex-president of the World Bank, was pointing to patently are fundamental flaws in the precepts and the practices of neoliberalism. Also, and as importantly, to the fact that our incapacity to understand those flaws blinds us to the economic history of our own present. How was it that the over-analyzed Asian and Latin American financial crises or the ill effects of structural adjustment in Africa sounded no warning bells for the future of the global north? Could it be because those things occurred outside of Euro-America, or because, blinkered by our own narratives of universal history, we've simply been unable to see the coming counter-evolution, the fact, so to speak, that the north is going south? To be sure, the North had foretaste of the downsides of market fundamentalism and of the forms of neoliberal governance that orchestrated well before the crisis of 2008. The contradictions that brought it to a head, after all, were long in the making. The relentless reduction of manufacturing heartlands into Rust Belt wastelands has long traced the deindustrialization of Euro-America. Recently, it has given rise to calls for reindustrialization, ironically by repatriating Fordist manufacture exported to and re-engineered in the South. Calls which now make little sense, since under present conditions, Fordist manufacture is no longer a viable possibility across much of the North. The contradictions of neoliberalism and its governance also flash into the public eye more dramatically from time to time. In the US, the implosion of Enron in 2004 made plain the fragility of an economy built on corporate greed and voodoo accounting. The Economist, a month or two ago, referred to it as déjà voodoo. A year later, Hurricane Katrina revealed to middle Americans the hidden effects on national infrastructure of the unregulated privatization of many of the critical functions of the state, not to mention the deep fissures of race and class among them. Brutal conflict in the banlieues of Paris, attacks on immigrants in the United Kingdom, the repression of Muslims in the Netherlands have played out similar themes, making clear how, despite their preoccupation with democracy and human rights, the nations of the North are witnessing rising tides of ethnic conflict, of racism, of xenophobia, of violent criminality, rampant corruption in government and business, and shrinking, insecure labor markets, of afflicted middle classes, lumpen youth, and much more besides. Africa, it seems, is becoming a global condition. Or at least Africa as imagined in Euro-America. Its own endogenous reality is a great deal more complex and not all darkness. Just as it has been in the past, the continent is also a source of inventive responses to the contingencies of our times. Responses driven by a volatile mix of necessity, a possibility of deregulation, and a space-time compression. Hence, among other things, the extraordinary, if uneven, expansion of its formal sectors and endogenous capital. The growth of informal commerce, the rise of profitable economies built on counterfeit and mimicry, and the emergence of new modes of service provision, what Hart and Negri have recently called immaterial production, the traffic that is in care, in security, in intimacy, in affect. The South has also led the way in the efflorescence of ethnoprize, what elsewhere we've called Ethnicity Inc. The boom in the identity economy is having thoroughgoing implications for the ways in which ordinary people experience collective being, social capital, and political attachment. And it is diffusing northward toward those metropoles that once saw themselves as beyond ethnic parochialism or tradition. Indeed, Scotland the Brave has become Scotland the Brand. As this suggests, the global South is producing and exporting some ingenious modes of survival, and more besides. It is often those most adversely affected by modernity who recommission its means, and its means most effectively and most radically, thus also to bring to light long-suppressed elements of its intrinsic nature. Indeed, it is precisely this that has pushed Africa, Asia, and Latin America to the vanguard of the epoch, making them the contemporary frontiers of capitalism, which, in its latest, most energetic phase, to reiterate, thrives in environments in which the protections of liberal democracy, the rule of law, and the labor contract are, at best, uneven. It is here that our two theses converge. Here, where the first, the claim that Afro-modernity exists sui generis, not as a derivative of the Euro-original, meets the second, the counter-evolutionary assertion that in the history of the present, the global South is running ahead of the global North, a hyperbolic prefiguration of its future in the making. Note in this regard that just a month ago, the South African Minister of Education unveiled what he called a charter for social theory. The time has come, he said, for the South to take a lead in the production of social science theory, all the better to understand the perplexing times in which we now live. This, at the very moment when across the global North, governments are closing down sites of intellectual production and becoming increasingly anti-intellectual, anti-theory. Perhaps Euro-America is not evolving toward Africa quickly enough, or in the best possible ways. Akoda, what might be the impact of all this for the very idea of the global South? What do we actually mean by the term? Despite the fact that it has replaced the third world as a more or less popular usage, the label itself is inherently slippery, inchoate, and unfixed. At its simplest, the shift expresses the collapse of the tripartite divisions of the Cold War era, in which there were two major ideological paradigms for configuring the political economy of modernity, each with its less developed others and its telos for their futures. In the age of neoliberal capitalism, of the so-called end of ideology, the measure of modernization is a good deal more crass. It lies everywhere in success or in failure in the global marketplace. In the upshot, the South, technically speaking, has more complex connotations than did the world formerly known as third. It describes a polythetic category, its members sharing one or more, but not all or even most, of a diverse set of features. The closest thing to a common denominator among them is that many were once colonies or protectorates, albeit not necessarily during the same epochs. Post-colonial, therefore, is something of a synonym, but only an inexact one. What is more, like all indexical categories, the global South assumes meaning by virtue not of its content, but of its context, of the way in which it points to something else in a field of signs. In this instance, most obviously, to the antinomy with the global North, an opposition that carries a great deal of imaginative baggage congealed around the contrast between centrality and marginality, free market modernity and its absence. Patently, this opposition takes on hard-edged political and economic reality in some institutional contexts, like the G8 or the G20, for example, and the world bond market or the world credit markets. But at the same time, it obscures as much as it describes. Two things in particular. We've already alluded to both. The first is that a number of nation-states of the South, far from being marginal to the global economy, are central to it. Although this is not reducing mass immiseration or lowering Gini coefficients in those places, it does ensure that they will become ever more integral to the operations of capital, not to mention of cultural imaginations across the planet. However it may be imagined, as Etienne Balibar puts it, the line of demarcation between the South and the North, between zones of prosperity and power and zones of the development of underdevelopment, is not actually drawn in a stable way. Quite the contrary, that line is at best porous, broken, often illegible. Even if it could be definitively drawn, moreover, many nation-states defy easy categorization. On which side, for example, do the countries of the former USSR fall? Or, if economic development is a primary criterion, where are we to place those powerhouses to which we keep returning? The likes of India, of Brazil, of South Africa, of Nigeria, which seem to straddle the cleavage between hemispheres. And this is not to mention the most portentous player of all, China. On the one hand, these are among the most dynamic economies on the planet. Yet, still being highly polarized, they are geoscapes in which enclaves of wealth and order feed off and sustain large zones of scarcity, of violence, of exclusion. Which is also true increasingly of Euro-America. In short, there is much South in the North, much North in the South, and much more of both to come. The second thing, which follows as both cause and effect of the inchoateness of the line between the hemispheres, is the deep structural articulation, indeed the mutual entailment of their economies. This, after all, is what makes global capitalism global, not merely international. Not only are the working classes of Euro-America, those who produce its means of consumption, situated ever more at southern margins, but as we've noted, southern capital buttresses even owns many of the signature Euro-American businesses, all of which is yet further complicated by the world of finance, whose labyrinthine capillaries defy any attempt to unravel them along geopolitical axes. In the complex hyphenation that links economy to governance, and both to the enterprises of everyday life, then, the contemporary world order rests on a highly flexible, inordinately intricate web of synapses, a web that both reinforces and eradicates, both sharpens and ambiguates the lines between the hemispheres. As a result, what precisely is north and what south becomes ever harder to pin down. All the more so, of course, as Euro-America evolves towards the world of its former colonies. Which is why the Global South cannot be defined a priori in substantive terms. The label bespeaks a relation, not a thing in or of itself. It is a labile signifier whose content is determined by everyday material and political processes. Analytically, though, to return to the point made by Homi Bhabha and the point that we want to make here, whatever it may connote at any given moment, it always points to an eccentric location, an outside to Euro-America. For our purposes here, its importance lies in precisely that eccentricity, in the angle of vision it provides us from which to estrange our world as a total global order, in order better to make sense of its presence at present and its future, a present and future in which the antinomy between North and South itself is likely to be erased.
Thank you very much. I would just collect questions if there are any.
Thank you very much.
Could you stand up so we can see you?
Thanks. Great.
Thank you for your thought-provoking talk. I wasn't sure the whole talk if it's an optimistic prophecy or if it's a pessimistic, but actually I thought it's an optimistic prophecy, other than the fact that it's UK and Euro in the north. You came from Chicago and you just went east to warn us or something like that. Then my major question is whether why do you keep the spatial language of North and South and just don't? I mean, I understand the discursive power over here, but I mean, why can't we just melt it and think of a different kind of conceptual model which is not North and South?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. I'll start and you want to go ahead.
I think part of the, you know, there's a whole discourse on Afro-pessimism, and people respond to it with Afro-optimism. I think what we're trying to say here is that, you know, it's neither one thing or another. I mean, the first project here is to try and understand what is going on. And when one looks at the story we're telling, it is a temptation as a person from the South, which I am, right? Okay. I mean, there's a temptation to say, you know, the North is getting its medicine, and we take. But the kind of progress that we're talking about here is a very dark kind of progress at one level, right? I mean, Africa and India and China are becoming the driving seats of a form of capitalism that's more rapacious than any we've known before, right? And it's in some ways because of the victories that were won by labor in North America and here that you can't re-export car manufacturing and shipbuilding, right? So that's the kind of one side of it that is extremely kind of, you know, dark to contemplate. It's now capital lives very well with fascism as long as you can control its spheres of operation, right? And African dictators can be as much a home to it as can be Chinese kind of, you know, contexts where, in fact, workers are much more exposed to danger than would be tolerable in the US, but you can make Nike cheaper there. But the other side of what we're saying is that that itself breeds a dialectic of critique. And the political inventiveness, the public discourse, the awareness of the nature of the process in which you are, of which you are part,
is so much more acute in many of these places that we're talking about, right? So that when we come back from South Africa to America, which we do regularly because we spend half the year there, and you see the nature of political discourse, right? Yeah. Or the degree to which people have accepted, yeah, that it is their fate to lose healthcare, to lose jobs, to, and you see that the South African situation still argues strongly for the fact, yeah, that there is a constitutional entitlement here, that we have a colonial history that sharpens us to the fact that you will not give in easily to these sorts of circumstances, right? And the very understanding, right from the earliest times of colonial history, yeah, and again, we keep coming back to South Africa because this is a case we know. Our point is this is a global formation. You enter it anywhere, and you try and find out where you're located, right? And from the earliest days of that history, there was an awareness of the dialectics of the colonial process, yeah, that held the line to the simple sorts of modernization ideology, right? So that people understood, for instance, yeah, that you took Christianity and you separated the message from the messenger and you made it into something because there was another message in there. Yeah. And not only was it a powerful understanding of the world and the ideologies of the colonizer, but it made for a highly dynamic form of... So those are the positive sides. But, you know, it's not an optimistic picture in any straightforward sense, but it seems to me that those terms worry me. Yeah? One has to, I think, you know, at one stage, one can be optimistic or pessimistic, but ultimately one has to understand from inside, it seems to me, the contradictions critically. And then you move from that to wherever your proclivities take you, politically or whatever. But it's not a happy moment, no. Not there or here. You want to do the
North-South? Yeah, sure. Please, just as often as I get the North-South, thanks. In fact, that question is critical, and it's the thing we battle with in the book. Because, in effect, we're not trying, in effect, to reinscribe the North-South, especially not as a geography. And we use eccentricity here basically as a critical theoretical gesture. What we're trying to say, in fact, is precisely that the relationship between the North-South and that cartographic imagination is based on, in effect, a reification of something that isn't there, but is nonetheless mobilized at critical moments. So, for example, when the global bond market identifies countries that are no longer going to be triple A, but only a double A in their credit rating, the Global South becomes a construct for them. It has incredibly, almost immediate material consequences. We know, for example, in South Africa or in Zimbabwe, say, or in Kenya, that if that bond rating drops by a half a percentage point, 500,000 people may lose work tomorrow. So it takes on a deep materiality at the same time as it's an illusion that in effect becomes sedimented. Now, the argument that we're making here is that in fact the North-South are part of a global system that is inherently unstable. It's constantly remaking itself, both geographically and imaginatively. And it's that we're trying to capture. So we use the North-South precisely as a provocation for its own reflexive deconstruction. This is about the contemporary world order. And using the notion of eccentricity is what is crucial to us here. Because what we're trying to say is this. We're trying to say that the conceptual repertoire with which we came to understand modernity, the modern world system, so to speak, really has its origins in the first age of revolution, 1789 to 1848. The terms like society, nation state, etc., with which the social sciences do their ordinary work, are all derived from that. We have the sense that we are in an age of revolution, but of course one can never tell this from inside of its moment. One simply cannot read history from its inside. But for the purposes of a political gesture and critique, the argument that we're making is that we're in a second age of revolution, which starts roughly, or at least is demarcated symbolically, 200 years later, 1989, right? 11-9 rather than 9-11. 9-11 is actually fairly trivial in those respects. 11-9 is a real marker. The end of the Cold War, its symbolic moment, the political maturation, at least the political economy, of the neoliberal moment, as it's identified from the South. Suddenly, the constructs with which we began to understand the world, concepts like society, like culture, like the nation state, all come under radical crisis, radical revision. The demand on the social sciences then is to, in fact, reconstruct its own understanding of the world, its conceptual repertoire, in order to make sense of exactly the same things we're talking about. Geography is the prime. in all this. Why? Because we have a von Humboldtian, Kantian view of geography predicated on the nation-state. It doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work in terms of economy. It doesn't work in terms of the law. These days, what counts in political action is the cartography of jurisdictions in the world. That is how many economic, political, rights-based decisions are made, and yet it has nothing to do with nation-states. It has to do with where courts will recognize jurisdictions, where money can move, where corporations can be sued, etc. This argument is about the eccentricity that is demanded such that we begin to understand anew what the conceptual repertoire of a post- or second-order revolution social science is going to look like. And the argument is that by looking at from the eccentric, which we call the South for this moment, precisely because we see so many of these things, and because, as Jean said, these are the objects of argument. You turn a radio any day in Harare or in Johannesburg, and these things are being argued about. In ways that in America, in Britain, have been shut down in time. And this is why the power of the eccentric vision remains for us, at least a rhetorical gesture by which it can, in effect, remove itself.
Yes, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure listening. I do have a certain unease, though, and it's not the good nor sound, but it's a kind of almost a feeling of reverse colonialism, if you like, because you use the term we and Euro-America, and that sort of homogenizes and lumps me into this category, where I think it is actually a pretty American view, and that's sort of North-South, and I feel that the old Europe, like the colonies, now gets homogenized through your narrative into something that actually seems, from my perspective, of sort of a northern, old European perspective, that's my we, there's relevant resistance to that curve that you're talking about. You know, there's major grassroots resistance to all sorts of policy decisions, citing decisions. There's sort of re-import of manufacturing from Asian countries back into Europe because of poverty, etc. There's sort of the German debate now about basic income, etc. It's a major relevant section of the population that's engaged in this. So it's not a sort of liberal Jonathan Safran Foer kind of vegetarianism, but it's a little rooted in real people. And I just wonder whether, yes, the global South may be ahead of the curve, but I think there are relevant reasons to believe that there are many attempts of sort of old Europe to get out of that curve logic altogether and do something different. I just wonder whether there's space for that in your...
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Although I may point out that the whole issue of basic income, for instance, this is the point we make, and we try to get beyond those polarities into a sense of a multi-centric dialectic set of processes, right? But it does seem to me to be interesting that in the recent G20 conference, it was China that held everybody in thrall, right? And in the example that you've just given us, the basic income grant was something that started where? Brazil. It was Lula. And the Brazilian example, which again, it's part of a constant processes of dialectics, right? But what is interesting about Brazil, for instance, is that it has enjoyed a strange relationship with its former colonizer. So that Brazil and Portugal now have a reverse relationship, just as Brazil does with Angola, right? And in a sense, it's not that that the one is definitively ahead of the other. We're trying to get away from those ideas of evolutionary structures. But what we're suggesting is that in the logic of these processes, right, there is a sense in which, for good and ill, much of the kind of the driving experimental core here, it seems to be on the peripheries for all of the reasons, ironically, that made them colonies, right? So Brazil, for instance, which has one of the highest Gini coefficients in the world, right, along with the US and South Africa, was the place that experimented first with basic income grants, right? And it was regarded, first of all, by northern economists. I have a student doing a PhD on this, so I've been looking into it. It was regarded as crazy, the massive, the most huge transfer, if you like, of wealth from the state to the poor. It was done in a very particular way, in a kind of microfinance neoliberal idiom, right, where people actually got credit cards, which they were. But the fascinating thing is, within a very short time, first of all in the South and then in the North, people were taking up that idea and elaborating upon it and so on, right? So it seems to me that is the question. And again, what we're trying to say here as a point, in a way, of entry, a little bit like Raymond Williams does with A Country in the City. Just as those categories become kind of lupin ideological categories with which we understand the modern world, it really reflects the fact that they are integral to each other. They are dialectically part of each other's reality as never before. right? And in a sense, I think this is what we're seeing, right? Is that there is this multilateral integration here, so that in a way it's very difficult anymore to say that the North and the South can be separated in these sorts of ways. And much of what you're seeing in underclass America, for instance, or in the housing estates of the UK, look very much like what you're seeing in Africa. But the particular connections between those points have a lot to do with a longer history of where the colonial and post-colonial relations are, and so on. So it seems to me that the problem with all of this is that these ideological categories, as John was suggesting, are both real and they're unreal. And we constantly try and foist them back onto the reality that we see. America sees itself as standing in dialectical block opposition to Europe, right, and to China. Right? And Europe also talks that way a good deal. Fortress Europe, you know, the new borders, that kind of thing. Right? And for those purposes, those homogenous blocks are realities. But when you start to deconstruct them and look at what's going on in Stuttgart and relate it to what's going on in Durban, you see that that's where the real interactions are. And I think that's what we're trying to suggest.
Thank you very much. And I have three points, but I'll try to keep them very short. So the first, I wonder why Toynbee used the term West-North versus East-South, just because I think that you would avoid talking about Western, whatever, the world, civilization, and culture. So how would we avoid, and why not to put West and North in some sense together? The second point is, my feeling and my impression is that you probably too much bring too much close to each other and link closely and directly the ideas of neoliberalism and what you call global North. And everything that is not neoliberalism, you call something like opposite to global North, and you call it global South. That's my feeling. And I think that this substitution is even easier when you call about the multiple modernities, because then there is a gap, there is a something in between, and which is not neoliberalism, but modernity, but still could be not European, not Northern, not Western, but Southern modernity. But the terms like Afro-modernity, I wonder if they really turn things upside down, because the very term modernity is, you call it vernacular modernity, but was modernity itself a vernacular phenomenon? Or it still was exported, and then here it took some vernacular shapes of development, but without the North or West, whatever color, was there any kind of the same modernity? I wonder, and it's intentional about conceptualizing the power relations. But I wonder if it really turns the things upside down. And I think that modernity still stays the concept brought to this area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see two rather than three, but let me start with the West, North, East, South. Really, as we try to say, the concepts of West and North, East and South, well, West and North, really have to do with simply forms of signification and the way that these have entered into popular discourse. As we were trying to say, and stress and answer that previous question, we don't see these as fixed categories anyway. The global South, of course, is simply a term of use that has emerged, and the joke is that this is the world formerly known as Stir, apologies to Prince, that these terms themselves take on various forms of sedimentation in public discourse. What we're trying to do is to decenter the forms of opposition and the fixities that are implicated in them, i.e. we try to show that this really evokes a fairly labile semiosis that takes on fixities and realities under certain circumstances and in fact merges into inchoateness and unfixity in others. So from this perspective, these aren't analytic categories. These are the shifters, the terms that we're trying to make sense of and to analyze. And to that degree, yes, you're absolutely right. One can align them in different ways. The relation between the East and the South is a very complicated one. And this is one that, in fact, right now, is a matter of extraordinary, a great degree of debate, especially in Africa, does one think of Singapore or Dubai as part of the global south or not? And for certain purposes, their rhetoric identifies, and for certain purposes, the East is something else. And it straddles, it plays the third term, which is why we said at the end that ultimately the most portentous player of all, China, is left out of the equation. And indeed, everybody's trying to fit China into the equation. America as a matter of foreign policy, Africa as a matter of interrogative. Gina and Gid probably, I don't know, what, 80 or 90 talks a year, right? At 90% of them, the first question we get is, and what is China really doing in Africa, right? Is this part of a new global southern axis in which Brazil, India, extending to China? That's asking us to divine the future of the world, right? The geopolitics of these things are deeply in flux right now. And this is the point that we're trying to make, that these articulations are not by any manner of means caught up by fixed signifiers. So you're right. To the extent that one creates and unfixes elisions, north, west, south, east, those are, in effect, the terms of label signifiers whose... labelness, this very protein party, is what we're trying to argue about in talking about articulations and dialectics across the world order. The question of we don't elide neoliberalism with the North and non-neoliberalism with the South. The South is deeply neoliberal, and this is the point that we're trying to make.
Big tradition.
The argument is the exact opposite, that neoliberalism is now a global phenomenon, and that it's being felt, if anything, very much more vividly in the South than it is in the North. In fact, when Tom DeLay can say, we won't have any form of labor union in the Mariana Islands, our continued colony, because we want to see what we can do to wages when we ban unions, is in effect a way of imposing precisely that on colonies from the North where they exist. But even where they don't exist, the capital, the imperium of new capital, does the same thing. It does the same thing by creating various forms of enclave by virtue of transformations in the nature of the state. The state more and more is becoming a franchise operation, right? It franchises and it licenses capital. And capital in turn pays for those licenses and keeps regimes in power. And this is replicated all over Latin America, all over South Asia, all over Africa. And what this means, in effect, is that governments more and more outsource the functions of government, right? So what they do is outsource them to the very companies, the very corporations that they then license in. Those corporations very often have their own police forces, their own armies, they bring in their own labor, the lot. They become literally mini sovereignties. There are many African countries that are really carved up into lateral. This is one of the points about re-theorizing the nation state from the perspective of the South. One of the things we go into in great detail in the book. We're used to thinking about the nation state as a vertical sovereignty. Political economy, political science 101. Except it doesn't look that way through much of the global South. What it looks like is nations, the areas of nation states, those geographies made up by horizontal sovereignty. Some of those sovereignties held by capital. Some of those sovereignties held by organized crime. Some of those sovereignties held by organized religion. Some of those sovereignties held by communities that, in fact, enclave themselves off. Let there be light. And on the seventh day, there was. So what is happening in these contexts is, in effect, neoliberalism playing out the logic of what is happening to the future of the nation state. Now, very similar things can be described of a hell of a lot of America. And here the point about to what extent is this America-centric is interesting. I can say the same about, certainly about Britain, that more and more the horizontalization of sovereignties is creating a very different kind of nation state in which the capitalist imperium is reconfiguring the South as well as the North. So we don't make any correlation between global, neoliberal, North, non-neoliberal, exactly the opposite. The point about modernities and their alternatives and the Afro-modernity, these again are constructs that have a very lively life, and they have an impact. Let me give you an example. One of the great debates in contemporary legal theory, right, is about whether the Kantian notion of dignity ought to be at the heart of contemporary constitutions. Since 1989, 106 new world constitutions written, all under so-called neoliberal design. They shift the nature of the law into the rule of law, into rights, etc., away from government. There's a whole literature of this. One of the interesting things has been, to what extent should these new constitutions be based on the universal subject and Kantian dignity? There has arisen an African jurisprudence, especially in 39 constitutions written in Africa, which say, no, Kantian jurisprudence makes no sense anymore. Why? Because it's based on a universal notion of the radically individuated personal subject. Africa has a different theory of subjectivity. It's based on the socialized subject in a construct called Ubuntu, which has very different notions of what then legal court forms of decision, of justiciability, of jurisprudence follow. Now, what has been interesting is that there's been a great debate in many parts of constitutionalism in the North as to whether, in effect, this Afro-modern notion of jurisprudence based on a socialized subject ought to replace a Kantian view. Why? Because it can absorb a socialized view of justice, can absorb an individual-based one, but not the other way around. In other words, it's a more capacious jurisprudence. Now, this has led to an enormous amount of debate in jurisprudence, in constitutional theory. In other words, here is an Afro-modern concept of the law, which is challenging seriously the constitutional bedrock of liberalism. Why? Because most of the nation states of the North are no longer caught up in what Gina joke is Benedictine history. Benedict Anderson. Remember? The homogeneous nation state and all that stuff? Well, that ain't any longer a very good sociological description of nation states, which are extremely homogeneous, to the extent that the Archbishop of Canterbury 2 years ago said Northern England should be ruled by Sharia. Okay, think about this. English law. Northern England should be ruled by Sharia. What does that mean for English jurisprudence? A very different beast. Something that looks much more like Africa than it does by England as envisaged by Burke, by Blackwell, and by its legal theory. That's where an Afro-modernity challenges a Euro-modernity. Two vernaculars, but two vernaculars in contest over the possibility of a different future for both. They exist. They're very much there. And they have a real impact on not only the world, but the way we have to understand it.
I have a few more people who would like to ask questions, so I suggest we collect them.
Sorry, a set of questions, so I start with multiple questions. I try to pin them down. So for me, it's a question, I think one of the main questions, you spoke about colonization, but we should talk about migration. And I think a lot of things you're talking about is maybe through migration in one sense or the other, and I think that's what it interconnects. And we have first the Colombia, which always had a back channel, but not so much, but there's now a huge back channel, and it makes it more complex. The second thing is still, for me, modernity is highly connected in history, let's say, of welfare state, of industrialization, of infrastructure. I think that is something where you really see a difference. And that is complex. That is a patchwork. So what is China? It has a kind of welfare state, heavily industrialization, heavily infrastructure, but other countries not. So that is a question which maybe there's a new way to arrange it, and it's not north, south, and east, west. Third is, to be concrete, the Rem Koolhaas example. I think it's quite interesting, because first he started with the president's helicopter, saw informality, which he in a way said, hey, that's something where Europe can learn from. That's a kind of neoliberalism at its best. And then suddenly he discovered, oh, it's not only the ants running and organizing themselves, there is an infrastructure of the 70s. And it's embedded in the infrastructure of the 70s, which is a colonial project, or post-colonial project, or however you would call it, or a kind of modernization project. So for me, that is a kind of example where it gets complicated and complex, where it is interwoven. And I would say South Africa is really the example where it all comes together. Yeah. It's a colonial state, a post-colonial state. Exactly. It's highly migration. It's a highly modern infrastructure. So that is a kind of blueprint of total confusion of all these.
That's why we're so confused.
Yeah. Thank you, first of all, for highly thought-provoking ideas. I enjoyed it greatly. I largely feel very convinced, but I had... The thing is, in a way, you presented a very polemical inversion of Marx's view of the colonized countries looking at their own future when they look at Europe.
Yeah.
And Marx, of course, was wrong, because the whole way of looking up at one's future already changes one's own future, and something completely different comes out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you used the sort of idea, notion of progress a lot. And in a way, I think it's an ironical, provocative use. But at the same time, in a way, while I like playful irony, at the same time I feel that it also stays bound with the idea of progress. Is there any way to think about what is going on in a way that is not always bound to this idea of being ahead or behind in time, of there being a line on which we compete as if we are running in a marathon?
Mm.
Thank you.
Mm.
Okay, you've partly answered my question, but I'll ask you anyway, because I'm sure you can add something. I very much liked your talk, and I'm very convinced, and I wish all my colleagues would, because I'm from political theory, and very much used there. But now comes the political theory question, which is how do normative claims come into that picture? And I mean, you talked about the rule of law, and this was sort of part of the answer. But I mean, there are things like claims for substantive or even strong democracy. Yeah. For rule of law, but also for social security, that the, let's say, liberal, but not only the liberal European tradition claims for itself and connects closely to notions of modernity, which at the same time in the sort of North American European academy I know debated as something which might be going away. There's all this post-democracy debate and these kind of things, but at the same time, that, at least that's my impression, are, for good normative reasons, embraced in many places of the global south. And not always maybe on the grounds of sort of alternative, indigenous, local forms of morals, but also on normative grounds. So yeah. how is that in your picture?
So this was the last question on my list, or person who had a question. Is there anyone else who would like to add another question? Otherwise, I would close. Please, one more.
I'm really very sorry. It's a very simple one. I couldn't help but to get the impression that African examples figure prominently in both the theoretical models and as well as...
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I've just got the impression, I couldn't help but examples from Africa had figured prominently in both theoretical and practical models. I just wondered if that's a coincidence or maybe different in the book, or if there is something specific, characteristic about African countries that prefigure the modern
things.
What did you do with these two?
To come to your questions, which are all, I mean, these are all fabulous questions and they're very provocative. Migration, of course. Migration, of course, but we've got to be very careful to not to assume that migration is something totally new, and I think you were implying that, right? That the whole point about colonies was that they were the intersections of highly mobile populations. And they only appeared to be mobile because the nation state formed, and the idea of citizenship and boundaries and the control and the institution of passports and so on interposed itself on what had previously been also a highly flexible world, and definitely within the context of Africa, though we don't see it that way, because anthropology and certain forms of political theory have liked us to think about it as a kind of bounded set of tribal, you know, billiard balls, that then come into confrontation with the coming of colonialism. All of the historical and archaeological work suggests that these were highly mobile populations. So it's relative, but certainly, the kind of intensification of everything, communicative flows, what we've been saying about the nature of not only the nation state, but the global division of labor, which has shifted things tremendously. And it's not just that we've exported our dirty and if you like, destructive industries to China and elsewhere where they've re-engineered them and started their own outsourcing, but it's that large numbers of people from those colonized societies, having been imbued with an ideology of universalism, human rights, become a Christian and the world is yours, they travel. They travel. And so cosmopolitanism is not just something of bourgeois intellectuals or even the mobile upper middle classes. Right? There are huge numbers of the population that have always moved and move ever more intensively, legitimately or illegitimately. And that migration has become essential to our mode of reproduction in the north, right? And elsewhere. Yeah. In Africa, it's a highly relative, and what we're trying to suggest is that the north-south thing is a relationship of centrality and peripherality that's imposed everywhere, within nation-states, within continents. Yeah. Within Africa is South Africa is the America to the rest of the continent. Mm. And there you're right. It's the coming together of all of those frontiers. But at the same time, and there I still think you have a highly European-focused idea of the modern. The modern may be associated, if you like, with a welfare state, with a certain idea, at least an ideal, a laudatory ideal of equality. But Haiti was also a modern society, a horrifying modern society. For most of Africa, modernity meant migrant labor, and it meant the constant living of the distinction between citizen and subject. Because divide and rule, ethnic division, the fact that you lived in somebody's house, the vast proportion of Central and Southern Africa households at some stage experienced migration. And it was migration often into white enclaves where you were a labor unit but not a citizen. You were a member of the family but not ultimately a human being. You were in the church but you didn't ever worship alongside a full fellowship. So that kind of... That was modernity. Right? It's another kind. And even in South Africa, the history... Why does South Africa have the kind of constitution it has? Why does it have the kind of grassroots politics it has? Part of it is a whole history of industrialization that looks very much like the making of the English working class. E.P. Thompson works very well in South Africa, but with a difference. Because, in fact, race was integral. The racialization of labor was there, and you could never have a Lockean view of the subject and their labor and the kind of, you know, if you like, the universal and colorless human subject, even ideally, because everybody understood the way in which the devaluation of labor works, and that colored politics. It colored the constitution that came subsequently. So these are dialectical processes. Of course, a lot of it comes from Europe. The whole point of colonization was that Europe colonized Africa, not the reverse. But it never colonized the way it wished to. And the dialectics of what emerged, you know, was it whether it was in the idea of what education was, or the face of Christianity, or the nature of music. All of this, right, was part of a dialectical process, just like Haiti has influenced the way in which we think about revolutions and the whole problem of inequality in Europe, right, at the center of France. So that's, I think, what we're suggesting. It's a dialectical process that moves back and forth. Right? And likewise, I mean, see, what else was there? What was the second question?
Progress.
Oh, progress. Whose question was progress? Yes,
progress. The progress.
Yeah. You know, I think part of what we're trying to pull apart here, between the distinction of modernization and the kind of hybrid modernities that emerge here, is precisely the fact that nobody is against, if you like, the betterment of the human predicament. Right? And much of the world, the whole discourse of equality, right, has been something that came with the nature of the modern world, which both talked about equality and progress and created inequality and tremendous distinctions, right? So the question is whether progress has to always imply the kind of colouring that assumes the movement towards the kind of end of history that the likes of Fukuyama talked about. Right? Does it imply ballot box democracy? Does it imply a certain kind of telos towards... Or is it an idea, an emancipatory idea of if you like, improvement, of striving, of the betterment of some... I mean, African societies have complicated discourses about the social. Their notions of democracy, the vision of what constitutes a moral subject or moral, or the moral capacities of people to strive, in particular categories, these are about certain kinds of visions of the ideal, right? And also ideas of transformation. The history of pre-colonial Africa involved centralized kingdoms, involved all kinds of processes of economic and political redesign. Yeah. Shaka Zulu, the famous military kind of hero of Southern Africa, redesigned militarism and created masculine regiments of a kind that had never been seen before and introduced new forms of citizenship. Now, indigenously, this was an improvement, but it's not progress in the same way as the Eurocentric notion of progress a la, if you like, a bourgeois modernity might have been, and it's not progress a la the Marxian idea of the triumph, if you like, of the proletariat or whatever. So these are highly situated ideas, and the more that places like Southern Africa have been drawn into global labour markets, the more they become part of a more universal language of the sort of vision of betterment. But very often, as we were saying about the nature of the South African constitution, there's a real rejection of certain kinds of ideas about what constitutes the rights of the individual or the most distinctive kind of vision of what might be improvement. There are tremendous debates about the nature of human rights in Africa today and whether rights discourse as a kind of form of individuated citizenship is the right way to go, and whether we shouldn't think much more about the idea of collective entitlements that don't fit easily around ideas of a workplace, but certainly don't fit into the kind of liberal Western idea of progress. So again, it's a dialectic, I would suggest. And a lot of it comes with Christianity, yeah, or with various forms of religious visions of utopia, but they get reworked in all kinds of complicated ways. And there are indigenous notions as well that are...
Yeah, that leads on actually seamlessly to the new normativity question. You're absolutely right. Normative claims always figure, especially in public discourses and normative transition. Okay, this is certainly so throughout much of the global South. The question of what does democracy consist in and how do we actually acquire it is very, very much on the agenda throughout much of whatever one wants to call it, but for these purposes. Places like India, South Africa, et cetera, of course China as well, but in a slightly different way. And the same is true of social security, the same is true of the rule of law, which are actually obsessional objects of conversation. After all, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have been engineered through the Global South and migrated precisely to try and create new normativities in the nature of citizenship. So, as it were, the effort to recreate the social, or at least something of its nature, really does run right through. And this is why these contexts are so challenging and yet so interesting to contemporary political science. Let's take democracy. Take Adam Jaworski et al.'s effort to try and define what are the minimum conditions of democracy, right? That whole comparativist project. Jaworski battles and battles and battles, and eventually comes up with a ballot box. If we have the ballot box, we have democracy. No Africa will accept that idea. That, after all, reduces politics to shopping. Once in 5 years, you have a vote, you spend it, like you spend your last dollar. But in all the, and there's a lot of survey work by political science throughout Africa, basically from Niger southwards on one side and from Somalia southward on the other. And they all argue about democracy as participation, as accountability, as again the rule of law. In other words, normativities, but normativities that don't simply presume what Basil Davidson called the black man's burden. That is to say, the importation of the presumption that the first principle of democracy is the ballot box. Quite the opposite. And in fact, one of the chapters in the book is about precisely why and how the ballot box has become a very poor measure of normativity. Why? Because, as we know from 2000 in America, elections aren't that hard to steal. Right. In fact, America afterward has developed some very refined techniques of doing this. We don't have to mimic the same thing. The point being here that all of these terms, what the rule of law consists in, what democracy consists in, what social security, are precisely the things under reconstruction. And here another point that has to be made. It goes back to an element of one of the implications of what you were saying earlier. Remember, these are societies in transition. Much of the Global South has undergone the whole notion of post-coloniality itself is a construct post-1989. After all, between 1947 midnight in August, remember midnight's children, until 1989, we didn't talk the language of post-coloniality at all. The term didn't appear. We talked about independence, we talked about after-colonialism, etc., etc. But post-coloniality belongs to a moment in which the old international system gives way to a global order in which what are emerging are global forms of jurisprudence, new geographies, we talk about it. All of these things created hiatuses in which new normativity become the object of public debate. And this is exactly what is happening right now, and exactly the basis for the claim of re-engineering our understanding of what normativity itself is. Because after all, if the nation state isn't a vertically sovereign order, then who and what are the subjects of normativity? Is normativity what organized crime brings you in your neighborhood when it behaves, a la Charles Tilly, like a state? And these are the big questions of the moment. Africa, yes, of course. It's no coincidence that we talk, as they say, out of Africa. We are both South Africans, right? We spend half our lives there. And it is the world we know best outside of the global north. But there is an argument about why Africa that is very much additional to biography. There are all social scientists hide their concerns in a great measure of biography, and we then abstract them into great principles, and we find terrific abstract rationalizations for basically talking about what we want to talk about, right? We suit ourselves. But the why Africa here is actually a bit more serious. It goes back to the question of Africa's peculiar history. Africa has for long been treated as the basket case of the world. Right? It is. If you had said 5 years ago to any economist seriously, Africa is going to have a growth rate of 16% in 2008 while the rest of the world has a 20% negative growth rate, she or he would have looked at you as if you were stone crazy. Because that's not what happens in Africa. Economy in Africa is all about extraction. It's all about the colonial extended into the present. It's not about consumer spending in Lagos. It's not about the production of new forms of markets and new forms of economic citizenship, etc., etc. So Africa has long been treated as the worst case scenario. So one can make the argument from the worst case scenario. One makes the argument more provocatively and more interestingly. Now, in talking about theory from the South, we are not posing or suggesting that we have a narrative to replace the narrative of modernity, that we have a theoretical solution. What we're inviting you into collectively is an argument. An argument which says, if all of the stuff that the old telos that constructed the narratives with which we got our social science, if all the truths which we got from the master narratives of the universal history, which we learned in the global north, are to be suspended, are to be literally held at bay so that we may understand the world again or over, that we may understand what happened in 2008 because we understood what happened in Asia or in Latin America or in Africa before. If we open ourselves up to the possibility of producing theory without the universal histories that have actually blinkered us to an understanding of the contemporary, then it's all worthwhile. And this is what we mean by provocation. Theory from the South is not a theory about the nature of the world. It's an attempt to pose questions about how we may understand the world anew if we start from very different subject position, from a very different notion of geography, which is not cartographical. We start with a very different notion of modernity, which doesn't take as one narrative its basis for all of our understanding of the present and the future. And that's all we're trying to do. It's a modest attempt to reframe the questions. Because what seemed to us at the moment to be lamentably true is that throughout much of the popular discourse of Britain and of America, those questions are on hold. Somehow, neoliberalism is the only way, the only scenario, the only map, the only script through which we can understand the world. And that seems to us to be wrong. There is a whole lot of understanding to be produced, a whole lot of provocations, and a whole conceptual repertoire to be rewritten. And we're inviting a discussion about that repertoire. Africa is the right place to start.